Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello there, welcome to another book club. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Charan Ranganath, who's written a book called Why We Remember, The Science of Memory and How It Shapes Us, which is very excellent. Hello, Dr. Ranganath. How are you doing?
Hello, Richard. Great to be here.
Good. It's really good to have you. I really enjoyed the book, which is very accessible, but also, you know, quite in depth about the nature of memory. Can you tell us a little bit about you and your work before we get onto the book and how you got into this subject?
Yeah, I've been studying memory now for just over 25 years. And every time I say that, it makes me feel old. but that's the way it is. I study a kind of memory called episodic memory, which is our ability to recall specific events from our past. And from the early stages of my career, we used techniques like electroencephalography, which was recording electrical activity in the brain. And then a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, to map out areas of the brain. And more recently, we've been studying patients with memory problems, patients with epilepsy with electrodes inside their brain, and we've been using computer models to simulate how computations in the brain help us remember.
Yeah, and it's a subject that seems to have progressed quite a long way in just the last, well, during your career, really, I think. You know, I'd sort of read a little bit about stuff. I knew about the patient who'd had his hypothalamus sucked out, which always stuck with me, and how that was meant to, you know, be the center of a lot of memory. But this book sort of shows that there's a lot more to it than that as well. And there's lots of the brain is sort of working together in lots of different ways to create lots of different types of memory in different ways, which how much would you say we know and how much is there to know, do you think, still? How close are we to understanding it?
Well, I think in some ways progress in the science means discovering how much we don't know.
Yeah.
And so I feel like we've learned an awful lot about the brain structures that are important for memory and the way memory works functionally. But we have a lot that we don't know. One of the biggest areas I think we don't know is how people differ from one another.
Yeah.
What makes your memory different from mine? And we don't know how much variability there is, and we don't know how to understand that variability. there's basic things like women's health. There's many factors in terms of, you know, issues with hormones and menstrual cycle that can affect memory. We don't know anything about men's health either, for that matter, and how those factors impact memory. And so I think we have a lot, we have a long way to go, but we also have built up quite a foundation and this ability to map out the brain and to model computationally how the brain works and to relate it and bring in findings from studies of animals like mice and rats and monkeys. I think it's giving us a picture that's unprecedented.
Yeah. I mean, it is really fascinating. What I love about this book is it is written in a style that's very readable. There's a lot of, I think often you think with a science book, it's going to be quite dry, but you bring in a lot of cultural references that certainly someone of my age enjoys. You're in a punk band. I understand you play in bands with other scientists.
That's right. Yeah. So I'm in a band right now called Pavlov's Dogs. So in April, we're going to be playing in Toronto for anyone who's interested. Maybe you can post the links.
Okay. Definitely.
But Pavlov's Dogs is actually a band composed mostly of memory researchers, neuroscientists. Right. And we gathered at a memory conference. And one of my colleagues asked me to help put together a group of people. And it started off as a truly shambolic performance after several drinks, and then became actually a real band. And now we've played many shows. We get together at conferences. We book a rehearsal room and we have a set. It's mostly punk, post-punk, kind of some rock, like, let's say, late Rolling Stones or David Bowie, Iggy Pop, things like that. And we played a big crowd. So I actually find it fascinating. I've been told that you know, grad students will come and they were some of the music was made before they were born. And some people have said they had to stop seeing us because they didn't want us to be the band that they've seen the most in their lives.
But there's a danger the band will be so successful that the future of memory science will be wiped. If you all go on to be rock stars, A, you'll lose your memories because you'll be to having too debauched a lifestyle to be able to remember anything yourselves, and be so don't get too successful. But the book, you know, I think it's nice. The book has lots of cultural touch points, and also is fun and lots of nice and illustrative stories, as well as being quite technically complicated. So it is, you know, you do learn a lot about you know, all the different bits of the brain and what each of them do. I mean, I'm really interested in this subject. There's a lot of reasons I'm interested in this subject because I've got a very good, I always had a very good memory. I think like you, I was very good at exams at school. I could always learn things very fast. I'm not so good now. And you do discuss in the book the middle-aged, you know, going in somewhere and not knowing what you came into the room for and not being able to pull up attention quite so much. But I've done quite a lot in my, I'm a comedian. I've done a lot of stuff in my work. I learned the first page of the New Testament and, which I did via kind of associating the words together. But now I can, you know, 10, 15 years on, I can still do it without even thinking about how the things are connected. So I've got that kind of memory. But equally, I've got aphantasia, which I don't know if you cover it all in the book, but it's sort of interesting you talking about bringing up memories like a film, which I cannot do. So my brain works in a, you know, as you say, brains work in different ways. My memory, which is pretty good, I think, of past events, does not have any images of those past events, but I still somehow remember them. Have you done anything on aphantasia in your work?
I haven't, but I've become fascinated with it, ironically, because I was writing the book. And I learned about aphantasia while I was writing the book. And then I told my daughter about it. And she said, oh, yeah, I have aphantasia. And so I was shocked by this because she's actually an incredible visual artist. She paints. She has other media, but primarily painting. And I never would have guessed that she doesn't see these images in her head. Yeah. But actually, I've learned that this is quite a thing and that there's many artists with aphantasia. And they work from having an actual photograph in front of them. And then their hands do the job, but they don't see it in their head with their eyes closed. So some people will say that they're more verbal learners. Some people will say they're more visual rememberers. And we just don't know what makes people different, to be honest.
No, it is true. I want to be cured because I didn't realize. I always sort of imagine. I kind of thought that I could see images, and then I realized that I could. You know, whatever, however I do it, it feels like the image is sort of almost there, but it's sort of out of the field of vision. It's very weird. But I'm not a good artist either, so I don't even have. I'm a very, very bad artist, and I'm a very bad navigator. So a lot of the things come up wrong. I also did a science experiment. I was involved as comedians having their going to an MRI machine I don't know what the conclusions were actually of this, but we played a game. They got comedians to do a game called Just a Minute, which we have in the UK, which is to talk for a minute without repeating, deviating or hesitating. And they were trying to find out if creative people, if they'd use different parts of their brain. So I've experienced that, having my brain scanned. I've got a scan of my brain on my Facebook page. I think they did conclude that comedians thought in a slightly different way, but that's sort of covered in the book. We talk about sports people and chess grandmasters, and I think comedians are the same. That, you know, well, I suppose any job's the same, where you have a memory of a way to deal with things, and then you can be very sharp and quick when called upon to respond.
Yes, I mean, for me, I can read papers on memory and just skim it very quickly and pull out the essentials very quickly.
Right.
And I think, like you mentioned, this is absolutely true for a professional basketball player. They can scope out an enormously complex set of information that's being unfolded on the scale of seconds, and not only figure out what's happening in the moment, but also project into the future what's likely to happen, right? So a great basketball player doesn't keep their eye on the ball. They keep their eye on where the ball is going. They're already lining up for the rebound before the shot has even taken place. And so, but this is something that I think many people have in different areas. You'll find that people who are bird experts have an incredible memory for birds. People who are experts in, you know, people who are major fans of football clubs can learn the statistics of a player effortlessly. And so we all have our own different interests and our own different expertise, and it gives us these superpowers in memory.
Yeah. And so, you know, there are animals, within the book you talk about, and as you mentioned earlier, there are animals that have similar, you know, similar traits and memories. At what point do you think, you know, I suppose with all evolution, it's very difficult to work out how the first memory cells were created and why. And how they develop. But I suppose it is just, for whatever reason, you know, this gives us and the other animals that have a memory a sort of huge evolutionary advantage, I suppose, just in terms of learning from that's I guess what it was there for initially. You learn from the terrible situations you end up in. If you survive them, you don't do it again, is basically the basis of it, I suppose, is it?
Yeah, I think you can certainly, for the human brain, but you can actually extrapolate this to many other animals. I mean, food, water, survival, you know, protection from predators, reproduction, all these factors are going to benefit enormously from memory. And so, you know, especially if you're an omnivore, being able to tell the difference between foods that are healthy and foods that are poisonous is pretty important, right? And sometimes you get one shot, and then you want to be able to remember from that one experience, not to keep repeating it by trial and error.
Yeah.
So memory is extraordinarily important. Some people, like John O'Keefe at University College London, feel that our ability to remember events emerged from a more primordial system that allows us to remember where we are in the world and to learn about spaces and learn about places. And I think there's some data to support this idea. Yeah. But I think also memory is really important for time. And I think one of the most important things that people, but also non-human animals, have to do is figure out cause and effect relationships. You know, if something happens in the moment, you want to be able to predict what caused it. And we've done some work on that and found, again, you know, this real core relationship between these areas in episodic memory and that ability.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, again, it's not something we think about very much. And it's one of those subjects that when you start thinking, I mean, it must be quite difficult when it's your job. When you start thinking about it, it's like when you're a kid and you start thinking about how infinite the universe is and how that works and your mind gets blown. When you start thinking about memory, I mean, pretty much all of our experience of existence is memory. There's this moment in the present that is ungraspable, and then everything else is memory, and even the future is, you know, you're using memory to predict. When you're thinking about the future, you're incorporating memory rather than anything else. So we are, you know, almost entirely composed of, our brains are almost entirely memory, and our experience of life is almost entirely memory, and that is sort of mind-blowing when you stop and think about that and the repercussions of that.
That's right. Yeah. As I mentioned in the book, Danny Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for his decision-making research, talks about the idea that there's the experiencing self that does things and lives life. And then there's the remembering self that makes the choices that basically the experiencing self is stuck with.
Yeah.
And the remembering self doesn't remember everything. It remembers the highs and lows. You know, it remembers the beginnings and the ends. And that's what guides our assessment of whether or not we've made the right decision. It just guides our decisions and guides whether we're happy or sad with it. So it's exceptional. I mean, just like if you take a moment and your producer said, how did that go? Are you happy with this interview? You're already in the world of memory just a few seconds out, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it is freaky. And I think also to think about, to be made to think, which I have thought about a little bit, in my podcast, I've ended up interviewing a couple of ex-girlfriends who have been successful in there. And then we've ended up talking about why we're no longer together in the interview. And their memory of why we broke up is entirely different than my memory of why we broke up. I'm pretty sure I'm right. But of course, we're creating false memories and a narrative that obviously to protect ourselves and to make us either to make ourselves the heroes of our own story or to make ourselves not as villainous as we thought maybe we really were. But it's sort of interesting how unreliable memory is as well.
Yeah, I think we can remember often very accurately, but there are times where we can go off the rails. And then there's many points in between. I think sometimes if we remember one part of an event correctly, we'll assume everything else is also 100% accurate. And I like to say there's no such thing as photographic memory because memory is more like a painting than a photograph.
Yeah, that's great.
So if I'm trying to paint a picture of you right now, I might be able to get some details that are really quite accurate. And I might be able to get some things that are distorted and inaccurate and violate some important aspects of your appearance. And I might put some things that are neither true nor false, but they're just reflections of my own interpretation and perspective. And I think this falls into the category of where you and your ex-girlfriends might differ.
Yeah.
I think I talk about in the book this line from Star Wars where he says that many of the truths that we cling to depend on our own perspectives. And it's absolutely true. Yeah. And you can even find that what happens is your beliefs in the present will color those memories. So even if you're in a healthy relationship at the moment, which I hope you are.
I hope so too.
Yeah. We won't go there, I guess. But even if you're in a healthy relationship and if you get into a conflict with your partner, it's really easy to think of all the things that have gone wrong, all the things that they've said to make you angry. And then you make up and everything's good. And not only can you not remember those things, but you can't even remember what you fought about. Right?
It's very true.
So our feelings, our beliefs in the moment are shaping our narratives of the past. And those narratives can completely change if our feelings and beliefs change.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I mean, there's so much in this book. We couldn't. I don't want to talk about all of it because I want people to read the book. But equally, we couldn't possibly talk about all of it because there's so much. But I think the malleability of memory is interesting, both in a positive and a negative sense. So you can help people through post-traumatic stress by making them, you know, look at the stressful memories in a different way. But equally, there's examples of people that you talk about, a guy who was convicted of, who confessed to a murder that he probably didn't commit, but got executed anyway because he was made to believe by the police that he'd done it, which is sort of terrifying that that's possible. And also, I think the way that imagination and memory are so linked anyway, that with some people it's, I mean, I think I've experienced this. Sometimes you have a dream and you can't work out if it really happened or not. Sometimes there's a dream that's so vivid you feel like, was that real? was that a dream? And you're not quite sure. And so there's people for whom there's very little distinction between imagination and memory. So all those things are fascinating.
Yeah. And again, it's just comes down to how our brains are not geared to regurgitate the past, but to derive meaning from the past. And so you might think, why would we have this wonky memory system that's so, you know, puts in all these like inferences that might or might not be true and incorporates so much imagination and can be subject to constant updating so that, you know, by the time we've recalled the story for the 10th time, it's quite inaccurate and violates a lot of our belief, you know, what actually happened. But the thing is that we're really designed to be economical and to form new memories for the bits that are the most essential and to use what we already know, to be able to fill in the gaps, to use imagination to glue it all together. And we're designed to be able to update those memories as we need to, because the world is not stable. And if memory is about the future, you want to be able to stop on a dime and change things at a moment's notice. So, for instance, if you have this restaurant that you love to go to, and then all of a sudden it's under new management, and then it's just horrible, you don't want to have to keep revisiting that and decide, oh, I'm going to give them another chance. Let's see how this goes. You want to be able to remember from that one instance, this is not where I'm going to go again.
Yeah. As I say, there's so many interesting, it got me thinking, you know, it's sort of so bizarre really that, you know, we are able to, you know, we have brains that are able to examine our own brains, which I wonder how common that is even in the universe, that being able to use your own brain to examine your own brain, that's your job. And that's such a weird evolutionary development that you'd get that far, that you go inside yourself in that way and that your brain is discovering its own abilities and finding out which bit does which and how those things light up and how they connect. Do you feel that we're sort of getting there in terms of understanding the role of each part of the brain and what kind of memories each, because obviously that's changed, hasn't it? It used to be like strong memories and weak memories, and now it's just different parts of the brain are responsible for different types of memories. Is the thing.
That's right. And I think a big part of memory, too, is how context dependent it is. So you have a memory that you think, OK, this is forgotten. And then all of a sudden a song comes on the radio or you get off the plane into a place that you haven't been to in years. And all of a sudden those memories come back without any effort on your part. So I think these are the kinds of paradoxes of memory. And I think what's interesting about you brought up about brain studying brains is, as scientists, we often come preloaded with our intuitive psychology about how the brain works and how memory works. And one of the exciting things about doing science is actually finding yourself having to constantly change your assumptions and constantly question yourself and question the assumptions, which I imagine for some people would be incredibly frustrating. And it certainly is humbling, but it's also what makes it fun and interesting. I feel like that's the best part of my job is when I have an aha moment. And that aha moment is, I was wrong, and now I've figured it out. And of course, it's ephemeral because then you have it all happen all over again. But now I forgot. What was the second part of your question? Are we figuring everything out? So are we figuring everything out? And I think one of the challenges I think we have now is we have a coarse idea of what different parts of the brain do and how, you know, they're connected with each other. But one of the things that we're just starting to understand is that information in the brain unfolds at multiple timescales. And what I mean is that certain computations can take milliseconds to happen, but those computations can be affected by something that happens seconds before and minutes before. And you can see this in the brain that there's ripples of things that happened several seconds ago, as well as effects that are happening in the present moment. And this is the result of brain areas that are interacting with each other. So just as your behavior right now is not just dependent on you, but it's an interaction between the two of us. Like we have a rhythm and a common ground that we're establishing. And that happens in the brain too. And we don't understand it yet. And so I think this is where really advanced computational tools will come into play to really unpack how memory plays out in real time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the thing I was thinking with reading the book, because I didn't with this book because it wasn't out on audiobook yet, but I often listen to audiobooks and I'll be walking my dog. And then when you get to a certain point on the walk after, you know, the couple of days after reading the audiobook, you'll vividly remember the bit of the audiobook you were at, which is associated with a place, which is often obviously a way that a lot of people use as a memory system, right? That they create a memory palace or however they do that in their minds. But actually, it's sort of interesting that something you think becomes associated with a place and then the thought sort of exists in that location as well, which is this is the same thing you talk about smells and music and all those sort of things can do that as well. I'm trying to write a book about, I was at a wedding and they were playing a lot of 80s music and they were playing House of Fun by Madness. And I was so taken back to sweaty school discos that I thought it'd be quite a good story in actually, you know, pining for that as a 50-year-old and then actually being forced to go back there and relive your entire life again. It would be terrible. But you know, you it's so sort of weird to the way that a piece of music can be absolutely associated with a time in your life and absolutely take you back there as well. I guess there must be, there's, it's the same. It's the same reason, isn't it? That a sound will be a warning, a place will hold a memory for a reason. But it's sort of it's interesting the way that it does it with these bits of trivia as well as things that are important to us. I was quite interested by the experiments you come up to, you know, the ways you come up and test your theories, and a lot of them are quite sneaky in terms of, you know, telling people something and then. Just and then changing it or saying now we're having another test. Is it fun coming up with those with those ways to trick your subjects? And how do you ascertain that you've got the right test that will not be? Because like if it was me, if you're coming to me, I go, all right, this guy's going to try and trick me. I know that, so I'm going to be ready for that. So how do you come up with your test, your scientific tests for these ideas?
That's a great question. I actually don't think about this enough. So there are some people I know that are just exceptional at coming up with creative experiments. So I would say I'm probably very average in terms of my ability to come up with these kinds of clever experiments. Some people just have these ideas for something that's just completely off the wall. Like my former advisor in grad school, Ken Paller, is brilliant at this. So he came up with this idea of saying he thought sleep was important for memory. So he said, why don't I just come up and have people memorize things while some sounds are playing in the background? And I can basically hack people's memories by playing those sounds again while they're sleeping and enhance their memories for the things that have activated during their sleep. You know, so that was one where I never would have thought of in a million years. But sometimes you just get like, I feel like there's different strategies, different people. Sometimes it's reflective of how people's minds work. So I know many scientists who are very systematic and logical in the way they do things. And so what happens is their next experiment will be a minor tweak of the previous experiment and a tweak of the previous one before that. And so, which is kind of, it's just probably the way science should usually be done, to be honest. But I tend to be more of a nonlinear thinker. And so things just pop into my head, whether it's music or whether it's experiments. And I'll just go, this would be a cool experiment. And then sometimes I'll work backwards and say, well, what's the question that this experiment will answer? And then I say, oh, well, that's the question. Then maybe this is the way the experiment should be done. And so you end up going back and forth. And sometimes you do want to trick people. Sometimes it's about it's really, though, often about controlling people in certain ways, like saying, how can we get a person's brain to do what we want when we want it? Yeah. And if I'm right, this is what's going to happen. But if my frenemy is right, then something else will happen. And so we're going to figure out, we're going to use this. We're going to take this poor subject and basically have them decide whether I'm right or my colleague is right.
Yeah. Got to be a lot of fun, though. I mean, I'd like to have some human guinea pigs to experiment on in that way, you know, in a fun consensual way, obviously, but it's
just extraordinary having the chance to scan people's brains and see what's on people's minds, you know.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that works, you know. That sort of feels that feels so sci-fi that you can put someone in a machine and see where the thought is coming from, but obviously that's why the situation has developed. I won't ask you this question twice, as would be the amusing thing to do, but there is a section about deja vu and why just assume I've asked it twice and where that comes from. I'm not sure I exactly got why deja vu. I understand it's a part of the brain, and there's a part of the brain that's meant to make us feel something's familiar. But why does it happen when I didn't understand why it happens when something isn't familiar? So deja vu is feeling something's familiar when it isn't, or supposedly isn't. So why does that part of the brain get triggered in that way?
Well, what we think happens is that there's something in your experience that deeply matches something that you have experienced in the past. Right. Even though it's different. And so our brains are constantly tweaking themselves to try to process information as efficiently as possible. And that efficiency can give us a feeling of familiarity. And likewise, when things are not very fluent, they seem very new and unusual, right? So there's certain things, like I talk about in the book, like, have you ever eaten a fruit called a rambutan? Yeah. Now, in theory, to make that decision, you'd have to go through an entire lifetime of memories to decide whether or not you did that. But my guess is that most people go, no, because they don't even know what that word means. And so just the effort it takes to hear that word is enough to say that they don't know, that they've never done it, right?
Yeah.
Unless you go on a lot of tropical vacations, which you might.
I have not eaten any of that, no.
Okay. Well, nonetheless, it's a things, right? So likewise, if things are incredibly familiar, you can process them very efficiently. But sometimes that happens under the radar and we don't even detect it. And so sometimes you can be in a place where it's very similar to a place that you've been to somewhere else in the past. And so even though it's your first time, if it looks enough like a place you've been, you can get this incredible sense of a memory being activated, even though you know there's no memory there.
Yeah.
And then you can often have the flip side of it, where you have the sense of a memory that's there, but you can't activate it. So that would be like if something's at the tip of your tongue and you know, oh, wait, there was that guy who was in that thing. What was his name? You know, what was that thing? And when did I see this? And you know it's there, but you just can't pull it up, right? And it drives you insane. And so that's kind of the flip of deja vu, where deja vu is like, I know this hasn't happened necessarily, but I feel like I've been here before. And this tip of the tongue thing is, I know there's a memory there, but I can't find it. But they're both reflections of this kind of process of trying to link up, you know, trying to access a memory and getting partly there, but enough to have some sense of familiarity, but not having any context to be able to put a story together.
Yeah, it's weird, but you know, it's weird to have that because it makes you feel like there's some, and historically, and obviously still for a lot of people, it makes you feel like there is some reason why this is happening, or it's some kind of prediction, or some kind of, you know, this is my, you know, we're living our life a second time, or so it's a weird thing to happen. But I think within the book, you sort of, you know, you give this idea that our memory changes over as we get older, and there are different types of memory. And I quite like that idea of as I'm moving towards late middle age and I'm becoming much, much worse at remembering things that have recently happened, that your role as an elderly person is to retain the knowledge of how to do things rather than the episodic memories that you had when you were young. I mean, that's an interesting, again, I suppose it's an offshoot of this rather than a predestined thing, but it sort of feels like that's the role of the older people in the community.
Yeah, I mean, humans are so weird, right? I mean, so many animals, as soon as they're no longer capable of reproducing, they die.
Yeah.
And humans, I mean, we might obsess about our lifespan, but we are capable of living much longer after we're no longer capable of reproducing. So there has to be some reason for that. And it's no coincidence, I think, that after 30 is when our frontal function starts to decline and we lose this ability to maintain focus on our goals, right? Because as you get older, it no longer should be about you. It should be about everyone else.
And yeah,
it shouldn't be about forming your own memories that are new. It should be sharing the memories and the wisdom that you've acquired over the years with the next generation. And I think this is one of the odd things about the world we live in now, is that we don't have an appreciation for these stages of life. And we just tend to think of that you should just be an adult when you're a kid, and you should be an adult when you're old, a young adult when you're old. And it's just nutty, because we really miss out on a lot of the benefits that we can have, especially from older people who, you know, are teaching younger people. I mean, I know my parents with my two nieces, so their grandchildren, they're like incredible at passing on all sorts of cultural knowledge to them, you know, and just a huge part of their lives. And I think it's a shame that in many, you know, in North America and Europe, we don't have more of that.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting how, you know, most of us have experienced this with some relation, unfortunately, is that people get older, that they lose their memory, and they lose their memory of who they are, and they're no longer anchored in time. And they don't, you know, my grandma didn't know anyone, really anything. I think she just about remembered her dad, and that was it, when she was 102, which is, you know, it sort of shows how important memory is to kind of keep us anchored to the world and to life. But also, is this research you're doing going to be able to help with that? Is it going to be able to combat the Alzheimer's and things like that, or is it something that you can only just comment on it?
Yeah, no, I hope so. I mean, we are definitely, I think we're definitely trying to. I would say that it's always multifaceted. So there's, you know, methods being done with plasma tests, for instance, that are going to be hugely impactful for identifying people at risk for Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
The research that we're doing is going to be helpful, I think, in identifying behavioral measures that you can use to say, hey, wait, I can't remember this part of the story that I just heard like a couple of minutes ago. Maybe I should be seeing a doctor. And finding these kinds of markers that you can use in behavior and MRIs, and then combining that with these other techniques to be able to identify people. Because I think to the extent that there's drugs out there that can be developed to improve, to treat Alzheimer's, you want to treat it before the brain damage actually happens. And
sure,
I think the big challenge that we've had is that we now appreciate that by the time someone comes into the doctor and they say, you know, I'm having serious memory problems, there's already been a lot of damage that's been done. And so you can't really reverse that brain damage. And so the best thing to do is get in early. So that's what we're trying to help with. And another thing I think we're trying to help with is develop computer models. So this is a really new direction in our lab, but we've been focusing on these areas which are like ground zero for where the Alzheimer's pathology process starts, and looking at the neuroanatomy results that have been done just in kinds of like studies of brains of people who have Alzheimer's, and then seeing how do these neuroanatomical changes cause the sort of breakdown of memory processes that we can see. And so we've just simulated this, and the results are just beautiful because they sort of put together what's happening in the cells to what's happening in the big picture in the brain overall. And so, you know, if we're eventually going to develop, let's say, some prosthetic devices or something to help improve memory, it's good to figure these things out.
Yeah. And we should say that being 56 as I am and not being able to recall the capital city or something or where I put my keys isn't necessarily the sign of something terrible about to happen. So that's fairly not, you know, these little things as we get older are going to happen, so it's not necessarily the sign of something you need to worry about.
Oh yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. I mean, memory naturally changes as we get older, and there's a lot of variability. But for some of us, we become more absent-minded. I know I am. Oh my God, it's just horrible, right? So I definitely have a lot of sympathy for this, and I think also another message that would be good for people to get is that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there, so to speak, meaning that we're finding more and more ways in which people can preserve their cognitive functioning. And yeah. That's important because everybody wants a drug, right? Everybody wants some kind of a cure, so to speak, for Alzheimer's. But we know right now there's things that people can do in their lifestyle which can measurably improve your cognitive health. And so we can sit around waiting for cures and treatments, or we can invest in ourselves in ways that really can improve our well-being in the moment as well. It's not even like you have to wait till you're 90 to figure out if your investment paid off, but there are things that improve our well-being in the present. Things like exercise, sleep, stress management, taking on challenges with mental health. I mean, these are all things that increase our risk for cognitive decline with age. We're even finding out about things like people who have hearing problems wearing hearing aids can be very valuable in preserving cognitive functioning. Nice. Being in a healthy relationship, being in a close relationship is very important. For whatever reason, loneliness is associated with cognitive problems. Right. Even the gut microbiome seems to be important. Things like having a sugary diet can affect your gut microbiome, which can affect your memory performance. It's just mind-boggling how many links there are between physical and mental health and memory.
Yeah, that's very interesting. A thing that I was talking to the poet called Lem Sisse last night on another podcast, who was brought up in the care system, and he had a very traumatic childhood. But he said an interesting thing, because his foster parents basically, when he was 12, said he had to leave. And so he lost all the anchors within family and everything. And he says he can't really properly remember anything between the ages of 12 and 18, because he didn't have the family, the anchor of family and everything that comes with that. And he was in this, you know, pretty unpleasant and traumatic experience. So it's sort of, I guess that's another thing as well, just having that security of knowing who you are and where you belong. If you don't have that, then it's actually very difficult to formulate memories.
Yeah, being in a very unstable environment too can just generate chronic stress. And that chronic stress can be quite bad for memory in the long run. So in a moment, if we have a stressful experience, actually stress can sometimes enhance the memory for that experience. But in the long run, if you have stress day after day after day, it can really have this just dampening effect on memory overall. Yeah. And so it's certainly an explanation for why your friend might be in that situation.
Yeah.
It also can be, too, that, you know, you might find if he goes back to one of those environments, it'll all come back. I mean, one of the nice things is you escape these environments and then you're in a different context. And so sometimes those memories can be in some compartment just sitting there, but they're not really affecting you. You know,
no.
I think there's this kind of myth that if you have experienced some terrible things in the past and you don't think about it, that somehow that's really like, you know, kind of unconsciously affecting you. But I don't think that has to be true. In fact, honestly, I don't think we know. And I think it would depend a lot on people's individual circumstances.
Sure. Look, it's all very interesting stuff. A couple of years ago, I had cancer, which I've recovered from, hopefully now. But I was worried about dying before my kids knew who I was, and I was trying to create memories. I was trying to create memories for them so they would remember me, which I very badly failed to do. And every time I tried to do it, it sort of went wrong. And so I am sort of fascinated by this subject. It's difficult to know, you know, you can't, I realized you can't force that either. You know, you can't like go, right, we're going to make a memory. The things that I think my kids would remember from that time were things that happened sort of organically, I think, interestingly, rather than trying to go, let's create a big memory for you all to remember your dad by, which didn't work. But it is a fascinating subject. We'll let people read the book to find out more. It's called Why We Remember. It's a really terrific read, and it's a sort of mind blowing, and it's entertaining, but it's equally. It's all that overlapping on itself and thinking about your own brain is I very much enjoyed. But there's loads of interesting stuff in there. So I'm sure it's going to do fantastically well for you. I always ask my guests if there's anything they're reading by someone else that they would like to recommend. Do you have time to read outside of your own area, or is there anything in your own area that you think is... I do.
I'm trying to think of the last book, though, that I was reading. It's like, okay, so this isn't really very useful for, like, I mean, this is, I guess I would say this is very scientific, but I've just been finishing up Thurston Moore's autobiography. So he was the guitarist in Sonic Youth.
And okay.
So yeah. It's a memoir, which I always find, I actually, as a memory researcher, I find these things fascinating because, you often ask the question of why people write memoirs, right? I mean, if somebody has made a name for themselves in film or in comedy or in music, why write a memoir? And so you see somebody's description of the past and you read into that, who is this person? And so I found that to be very interesting. So he has a very, like, he talks a lot about not his own experiences as much as he uses his experiences as a vehicle to talk about this entire art and music scene that he grew up in. And I thought that was fascinating. I think it's a very clear window into who he is and his artistic mind. And I just love that. So
good. Is it difficult to read memoirs? Cause you're thinking, oh no, that's not a real memory. Or you're saying that to justify what's happened here. Are you constant? I mean, I'm a bit like that. I have to say, I'm always reading between the lines with memoirs when I find those ones where people write very effusively about how brilliant they are. And never say anything's failed. You kind of go, this is an insecure person who's ignoring all the times they failed, and luckily all those have fallen out of their memory. Maybe if you've got that kind of memory that just remembers your triumphs and doesn't remember your disasters, that's why people are successful, I guess, that they can ignore the memories that for me will never go away. It's why I'm a comedian. All my worst moments are the things that I remember most vividly.
Well, yeah, that's right. But again, being I always like to say there's no point in having something bad happen to you unless you get a good story out of it.
Exactly.
Right? You could see some of mine in the book. Sure. Yeah. But, you know, these memoirs are just so cool because it's like, often I read them because I think I know this person. And then you realize, no, I don't know this person. And then sometimes you can see people, you're seeing their memories from your own perspective, an external perspective. And you can see something that often they can't. People will often write these things with a particular agenda and they don't have this ability to see themselves from the outside. I found that in some musicians' things where they're trying to sound normal.
Yeah.
And then but they actually sound totally ridiculous, but they can't see it because you're not them.
I love that. That's one of my favorite things about reading, especially comedians' autobiographies. I understand comedians and you can tell when they, when they've missed the point about their own stories and how it reflects on them. It's a terrific thing. But there we go. That good recommendation. Yes, look, thanks so much. Yeah. It's such a delight to talk to you, and it's such an interesting book. Why We Remember by Dr. Sharan Ranganath. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us about it. I will never forget this experience. I probably will. I forget most of the things I do these days.
But next time I see you, it'll all come rushing back.
We'll see. Thank you very much. That was terrific.
All right. Thank you.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.